This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the debates are over, both at the presidential and gubernatorial level. We look at how these meetings between Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Pat McCrory, and Roy Cooper may impact their elections. Emails bring us insight into goings-on behind the scenes. This time, those emails come from the governor's office and concern jockeying over HB2. Charlotte gets a new city manager while the U.S. National Whitewater Center operates under new water quality regulations, and we have more details on the search for a new CMS superintendent. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Congratulations on saying my name right.
You're welcome. They represent the broadcast side of things, and this week we have two intrepid writers for the Charlotte Observer with us. Ann Doss Helms covers education, and Eric Frazier is that nasty editorial writer for the paper. Welcome back.
Bad on breaks.
That's right. I'm the nasty woman. He's the bad one.
Exactly right. Let's start with the debates and a remarkable distillation of the debate last Wednesday night that was put together and aired yesterday by PRI's The Takeaway.
It really does come down to what kind of country we are going to have.
The problem is you talk, but you don't get anything done, Hillary.
A pattern of divisiveness, of a very dark and dangerous vision of our country.
I'll keep you in suspense. When you look at her real record, take a look at Syria, take a look at the migration, take a look at Libya, take a look at Iraq.
Went after a disabled reporter. He went after Mr. and Mrs. Khan. He went after John McCain. He went after a federal judge born in Indiana.
The Supreme Court, that's what it's all about.
We have come too far to have that turn back now.
I am pro-life, and I will be appointing pro-life judges.
Government has no business in the decisions that women make.
I want to build the wall. Hillary Clinton wanted the wall.
It means you would have to have a massive law enforcement presence.
At a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. Some bad hombres. We're going to speed up the process bigly.
City choke. Well, let me translate that if I can.
We think how great they are. Terminated.
You are the most dangerous person to run for president in the modern history of America.
Lots of luck, Hillary. Thanks a lot for doing a great job.
This is a pattern.
It's what it's all about.
Made it almost sound fun. What a fun evening that was, huh? The big news out of that debate, obviously, was the fact that Donald Trump wouldn't say at the time that he would accept the outcome of the election. He has since said that he will accept it if he wins. What has been the fallout from that as of this morning?
Well, I don't think anybody knows the fallout yet because we have to wait to see what's going on. And Donald Trump is speaking in Nashville Friday. And I'm willing to bet that he's going to amp up that same talk. And if you stop and think about it, it's really fascinating because I've never, ever seen anything like this, anything about a major party presidential nominee even slightly questioning the outcome of a U.S. election. If you look at Al Gore, you know, let's face it, one of the most contested elections, I would say Al Gore and George Bush in 2000, that went to the Supreme Court. And in a way, it's almost an ultimatum on the election itself. It's almost like Donald Trump is saying, vote for me or else. Now, we don't know what the or else is. But what's fascinating is how people are translating his statements because they are vague. There's nothing direct yet. But you have Renee Elmers, who's a North Carolina congresswoman who lost her primary fight, who's become a big Trump surrogate.
Only member of Congress to be endorsed by Donald Trump.
And she's been out there saying, well, what he meant is he's treating the election like a contract, like a business contract. She has to translate that thought. What's concerning, and I think what should be concerning, is what about – that's her point of view. What about other people? What about other people and how they translate those statements?
Well, there's two things. He's questioning the outcome of the election. He's calling the election system rigged, and he's saying, I may not concede. All of those things are unprecedented. So what has been initially Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, kind of distanced himself. Lindsey Graham was among the first people to come out and say negative things about that comment. What have been mainstream Republicans' reactions as of this moment to that? Because this is serious stuff.
Well, I think it's interesting that they've been saying, well, of course we'll accept the results of the election. That we would never refuse to acknowledge an election.
But are they distancing themselves from the man who's saying things like that?
Well, they're also saying things like, well, but maybe we won't confirm Supreme Court justices, just like we haven't confirmed.
That's not news.
Right. But, but it's, you know, you can say you accept the results of the election, but if you then refuse to work with the system, that's almost, to me, as troubling as whether Donald makes a concession speech
or not. And the key thing is, look at what the North Carolina Republican Party did. Dallas Woodhouse put out a statement, or actually talked to reporters and said, as far as he knows, it's not a voluntary thing whether you accept the outcome of an election or not. But the North Carolina Republican Party is still 100% on board in supporting Donald Trump. So what you see a lot of people do is, you know, try to walk this fine line of, no, we disagree with that, but he is our party's nominee. That phrase we hear time and again. That doesn't matter, though, because the key thing is what his supporters really think.
True. But at what point do people whose future political careers depend on the outcome of this election, do you put patriotism or the good of the country in front of the good of your presidential nominee?
Well, I think what will be interesting will be how this all plays out on election day. Mm-hmm. If indeed, say you have a situation in North Carolina where Richard Burr edges out Deborah Ross in North Carolina and wins, and Trump narrowly loses to Hillary. And if you've got Trump then saying, you know, it's rigged, it's not fair, I don't accept those results, how's Burr supposed to feel about that when he's won in the same election and the same voting and Trump is his guy?
Well, there are a couple. Go ahead.
Here's the thing that we also need to remember, at least in North Carolina, is that Republicans run the Board of Elections in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. It's run by the party that belongs to the sitting governor. So the State Board of Elections is run by Republicans. The executive director is a bulldog Republican who made her name for herself prosecuting Democrats. Every county Board of Elections has two Republicans and one Democrat. And so for conservatives or Trump backers or whoever to say in North Carolina and suggest that the system is rigged against the Republican nominee in a system that is run by Republicans so much that we've gone to court to undo what they've decided, I think is a bit ridiculous.
And you also have this problem with Donald Trump saying the election system is rigged and I may not accept the final results of Republicans having to come out and say, no, the system is not rigged. There's integrity in the system. This is after months of people in Republican positions around the country saying, there's voter fraud everywhere. That's why we have to have voter ID laws. It puts them in a really tough position, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, although you can always fall back on the media being rigged. You know, that sort of seems to be the go-to position as well. Even if the polls aren't rigged, the media is stacked against me. I mean, Clinton gave during the debate a great litany of all of the things that he has declared as rigged if he doesn't win. So if he doesn't win, you know, it's an interesting position. I accept the results of any election that I win.
There was also a gubernatorial debate here in North Carolina this past week. There have been two, I think, televised debates here between Pat McCrory and Roy Cooper. The last one included Libertarian Lon Cecil. Who? Why was he there? Why wasn't he in the previous debate?
Well, this debate was set up by WRAL-TV in Raleigh, and I think it's good that they had a third-party candidate in there. I would agree with that. And, you know, quite honestly, he didn't make a huge splash. But let's face it, libertarians are one of three parties in North Carolina that have a specific slot for a reason. I think having a third-party option is always good. Now, what did he have to say at that debate? You know, I watched it. Not a huge amount. I mean, it was really fascinating because as Pat McCrory and Roy Cooper were just body-blowing each other, Lon just kind of stood there and answered questions politely when he was asked. When it came to HB2, he said, you know, I think we should keep the bathroom part but repeal the rest of the law. And when it came to rebuilding areas that are constant flood risks and hurricanes like Matthews, he said he's an engineer and he spoke like one. He said, you know, we need to look at setbacks. We need to make sure that we're not building on ground level in these areas. He didn't really stir any controversy or make any statements that I think make much news. But if you're a libertarian, I think some of the things he said would probably surprise you because he did seem to support more government action. And I'll give an example. When it comes to non-discrimination, he said that everybody should be included in the non-discrimination clause, which, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a libertarian, a classic libertarian, it means you're supposed to just go for small government and let everything else kind of settle itself out.
Did they pretty much go over the same things they went over in the previous televised debate? I know they sparred again over the rainy day fund, which has come into good use because of Hurricane Matthew. Mm-hmm. Roy Cooper said there's too much money in it, which is also a reverse of what Republicans and Democrats used to say. Republicans used to say when there's too much money in the rainy day fund, you need to lower taxes because you're bringing in too much revenue. It's the other way around now. Did they make any points on that again this time around?
Well, except I think Republicans would argue that they have lowered taxes and it's led to increased revenue. Okay. They just touted their $100-something million more for the mm-hmm. first quarter. And they would point to and say it's because of our – and we've lowered taxes and we're still getting more revenue. I think the most interesting thing that came out of the gubernatorial debate was the back and forth between Roy Cooper and Pat McCrory that's now kind of turned into a political circus over Roy Cooper saying that Pat McCrory was under investigation by the FBI for the favors that he allegedly did or didn't do, depending on who you're talking to, for Graham Keith, obviously, of Charlotte in the prison contracts. And, of course, after that, we were able to learn that the FBI and federal prosecutors decided not to bring charges as a result of their investigation.
Was just so odd that they didn't say that McCrory didn't say himself earlier that he was not under investigation.
Yeah, you wondered, was he setting up something like that?
Yeah.
It's the local news roundup here on WFAE. Okay, and I'll go ahead and finish that thought.
I thought the same thing, that if you learn that you have been cleared, that there's an investigation or whatever it was, a looking into, and there's nothing against you, don't you put out a press release if you're the governor? And maybe he wanted to be in that position.
Not during an election year, because, again, you're pointing to the pointing
reminding
to the fact
everyone that
you were looked at, whether it was investigation full on or not.
I mean, there's a big difference between being investigated by the AG or by a local DA and being investigated by the FBI and federal prosecutors. And that kind of stuff is just things that no one talks about. You know, I had someone else ask me yesterday, well, don't you think the Attorney General's office was told that the FBI finished their investigation?
Nope.
No. The FBI doesn't want to. I'm surprised they confirmed that they had concluded their investigation.
Right.
That actually came from the U.S. Attorney's Office. But, you know, federal investigators, federal prosecutors don't ever want to talk about that. But it has become quite an interesting issue now because Republicans are accusing Roy Cooper of, you know, purposely misstating things about an investigation.
Yeah, that's just such an odd, you know, sort of messaging point or political tactic to take when nobody thinks he even knew.
Pat McCrory called on Roy Cooper to resign right at that moment when he said that thing.
It's weird.
There was another really strange moment, I thought, in the debate, and I wanted to fact check it, so I went through and checked campaign finance records, and it came when Pat McCrory decided to paint Duke Energy as being in the pocket of the Democratic Party writ large. And he talked about how they gave a $10 million loan to the Democratic National Convention when they were in Charlotte, and that loan has yet to be paid back, that they have given tens of thousands of dollars to Roy Cooper over his different elections. And clearly Duke Energy is right there with the Democrats trying to bring – you know, trying to stop Pat McCrory from getting elected. And it was an easy thing to fact check. It was just fascinating. It's like, yeah, they've given tens of thousands of dollars to Roy Cooper, but they've also given tens of thousands of dollars to one, you know, Pat McCrory. And it was just really this odd moment. I just did not expect to see Duke Energy painted as a big, super liberal, you know, funding mechanism.
Early voting started yesterday, and evidently around this area at least, there were big crowds, mm-hmm. long lines. What does that portend?
I think, if the conventional wisdom about these things plays out to be true.
That's the wrong year for that. Try again.
Wrong.
Yeah. but go ahead.
But if it turns out the way it normally does, larger turnout tends to benefit the Democrats. So we'll see. I don't know. This could be an odd year.
Well, let's first flat out say this is an odd year in every aspect. But, you know, I'm curious to see what happens. We won't know the results until election night. But it could also just show that both bases are really fired up. And
true.
North Carolina is super close.
Well, we're going to continue with this little conversation as we cover other stories in the news, including emails revealing the inner workings of HB2 in the governor's office, among other things. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock, gathered around the table. He's from WFAE News. Nick Oxner.
Ah!
With WBTV News. And Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer as well. What would the news roundup be without a conversation about HB2 and thousands of pages of emails were provided this week to the Observer, which shed some light on what was going on behind the scenes at state government, particularly in the governor's office before, during, and after the passage of HB2. What have we learned from these emails?
Well, we got an underscored point to something that we already sort of knew is the big takeaway is that the governor's office and the governor specifically did not want HB2 to pass in the form that it did. And you recall he kind of hinted at this before the special session was called to the legislature that passed HB2. He said, look, I'm not going to call the special session. He didn't. When he issued his statement after he signed the bill at midnight, less than 12 hours after it had been passed, he said, I didn't really want to sign this bill, but I'm going to. And that was underscored in an email from the governor's general counsel, Bob Stevens, to one of his former law partners, where they said, look, we asked them to make changes, we asked them to do this differently, and they didn't. And another interesting point, and props to the Observer, that we only have these emails because the Charlotte Observer had to file a lawsuit and go to court, yeah, because the governor's office refused. It is one of now like four lawsuits pending against the governor's office for them refusing to provide public records.
And I want to add two more takeaways to what Nick said, and I think he's spot on. First of all, they also knew right off the bat that tech companies were really against this law. They were against the bill before it passed. Apple, one of their law firms is Parker Poe, and apparently they were saying, look, our client has huge problems with this. Do not pass this. This could cause economic ramifications. The governor's office knew it, and yet he still signed the bill the same night. I mean, it was 12 hours. Well,
but that was the bigger interesting takeaway in the Stevens email,
yep,
is when he said, look, what was he going to do, veto it? Because it would have been overridden by the General Assembly.
Still, the other email there that I thought was really interesting is you see a couple of them where basically you have Republicans writing to the governor's office demanding that he call the special session, saying there will be political ramifications if you do not call it, which he did not, and saying that if you sign the bill, in essence, that will make up the ground for your political base during an election.
So would you say that these emails show that Pat McCrory actually has a different set of feelings or thoughts about this bill than what he's presenting publicly?
I think it pretty much underscores what we already knew, which was that he was somewhat reluctant to go along with HB2. It went further than he wanted it to go, but he kind of was sort of the –
got on board.
Yeah, and he just kind of got dragged along.
Well, dragged is right. I think these emails just underscore the rock and the hard place that he continues to find himself between on this issue. And I mean, he was the one, if you believe him, leading the charge to try to work out a compromise that didn't happen in May, too. And so I think he didn't want this to happen. It happened. He reluctantly supported it and signed it. And we can talk about, you know, whether or not he did that appropriately and the optics behind that. And then he tried to change it. That didn't work. And now here he is.
Is this the reason why the governor's office fought not to release these emails?
I think so. It doesn't make him, in the end, he does not come out looking like a strong, assertive, you know, the power in Raleigh.
Right.
No,
not at
all.
But the governor's not the power in Raleigh. I mean, it's a good reminder.
But it does make that clear. Right?
But you don't want that.
These emails, though, point out that, and they also point out the fact that it seems like he was jockeying afterwards for political favor during a political year. So, you know, I think the quite honest reason, though, he probably didn't want these put out as well, is he knew it would be news when they did get out, and therefore we would be talking about it.
And I do think public bodies sometimes play the war of attrition. You know, if I ignore this request enough times, you know, there are a lot of things on your plate as a newspaper, as a news organization. Maybe this will just go away, and they must win some sometimes.
Which is why, and it's expensive too to file these lawsuits. Which is why, again, kudos to the Charlotte Observer for doing this, and why also though it is so important for news organizations and anyone else who cares about transparency in government to continue filing these lawsuits to tell people, look, we have a law and we will enforce it and we will use it to get access to the information that belongs to the people.
And these emails include communication from Tammy Fitzgerald of the NC Values Coalition urging supporters of the bill to rally behind Pat McCrory and his reelection campaign, also suggesting that they push back against major corporations opposing HB2 and raising doubts about whether the NBA would actually pull the All-Star game from Charlotte. Fitzgerald wrote, only the NBA has made a threat, and it was not very overt. I think if we push back loudly, they won't want to risk angering the majority of their consumers.
It really underscores just how the religious right, the folks who were, you know, sort of pushing from the right really hard on this, did not understand the ramifications of what was about to happen. They just were totally, they did not see this.
Although, you know, in a way, does the religious right worry about that? I mean, the more pitched the battle, the better for the interest groups to some degree.
True, but there were some emails in which people were telling McCrory's people that this was going to be politically popular. No, it's not.
Well, within their circles.
Well, it is within the Republican. It is within the Republican base.
And
HB2 has gone to serve Pat McCrory in firing up and endearing the conservative base, which is, you know, an all outside the metro areas that, you know, McCrory did not have real strong conservative bona fides before because he's been such a moderate. So.
He's told me on this program that when he leaves Charlotte or Wake County and he goes to Shelby, I think that's the city he actually chose to use as an example, people come up to him and thank him for his support, whereas in Charlotte, they're spitting on him, essentially.
Well, I wouldn't say people are going to be spitting on him in essence in Charlotte, but I wouldn't be surprised to see people in more rural counties where this is popular. I mean, that's one thing that it is worth pointing out. Here in Charlotte, this is obviously an incredibly unpopular law. But North Carolina is split. Now, public opinion polls have shown a trend where more people now are against House Bill 2 than were for it, that they see that there is an economic ramification and a reputational ramification to it. But that wasn't the case when it was first signed.
And it does highlight the way in which we live in separate societies these days. You know, there are people who cannot imagine voting for Hillary Clinton and don't know anybody who would. And then there are other circles where the opposite is true. Same with House Bill 2. Same with almost everything out there. You are convinced that everybody thinks like you.
And in fact, it depends on where you live. And we're talking about that on this program on Monday, the intersection of place and politics and how where you live informs what you think and believe and how you vote. We'll do that Monday.
That was a nice plug, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Nice
segue nicely into the promos. You have some news about Governor McCrory and his staff making changes to a letter in 2015 over coal ash that we've talked about on this program countless times before.
You know, you can't say HB2 without its favorite cousin, coal ash, right? The topics that come up over and over again. And so yesterday, we got copies of deposition transcripts and ongoing litigation surrounding coal ash, filed largely by environmental groups and represented by the Southern Environmental Law Center. And these depositions, there were two new ones. The key one, the new one that we saw yesterday was of a woman named Kendra Gerlach, who's the communications director at what is now the Department of Environmental Quality. And she testified to two key points, the first being that the McCrory administration, someone from the communications office in the governor's office himself, sent over language that was inserted into the letters that were sent to homeowners with water wells near coal ash facilities.
Which letter? The first letter?
The first letter, the do not drink. So they're commonly referred to as the do not drink letter and the okay to drink letter. And so the do not drink letter went to residents with water wells near Duke's facilities and said, look, the level of hexavalent chromium in your water exceeds this new state standard that we've come up with under this new law, so do not drink your water. So that there was back and forth over what the language to put in those letters. Ultimately, it included several kind of clauses and disclaimers that said, look, we're telling you don't drink your water, but federal law, the federal drinking water standard says your water is safe. Well, we now know, according to Kendra Gerlach, that ultimately the language inserting the bit about the federal drinking water standards came from a fax. I don't know who faxes in 2015. Came from a fax from the governor's office to her office at DHHS, and because of that letter or the fax, they inserted that language on the federal drinking water standards into the final version of those do not drink letters. Now, this
it softened the language is basically what it did. It softened the language, and it directly contradicted the state's standard that was created actually under the law that was passed because in the aftermath of the Dan River spill. And it actually helps to buttress up the accounts of a state scientist who has been just, you know, gone after by members of the Macquarie administration. I think that's a fair assessment, especially when you have the governor's –
well, they accused him of lying under oath.
And, and in a, like a midnight press conference called by the governor's chief of staff.
Right.
And it also backs up why the state's top epidemiologist resigned, mm-hmm. saying that she would not work for an administration who is deliberately trying to mislead the public.
So this essentially confirms what she is alleging.
Yeah.
Well,
it
doesn't
buttresses
confirm,
their
but
argument,
it, yeah.
but it's not a full-on smoking,
yeah. You can understand why she left.
Yeah, it adds some additional credence to it. And look, it's just the latest development in a very – so, of course, the administration – it's important to say what DHHS says here. They say that that language had already been agreed upon by the secretaries at what is now DEQ and DHHS, and it was in earlier versions of the letter. It had been taken out. That softening language had been taken out. It was still out in the final drafts that they had brought over to the governor's office in a meeting that's the subject of much controversy, and then it was put back in. At the last minute, according to Kendra Gerlach, because of this fax that was sent from the governor's office.
And one other thing that we haven't talked about is now we also know of a conference call with Duke Energy,
yes.
and members of the people who are working on these letters. Now, Duke has come out and said that, you know, they were just trying to understand this new law and what was going on. But the fact that this conference call happened and nobody knew about it until these depositions raises some, you know, fair questions.
And this is the first time we've heard that members of the Macquarie administration were actively talking with Duke Energy. Now, Gerlach she didn't really remember much of anything specific in her deposition, and she didn't remember the exact timing, but she did say that this conference call did definitely take place before the state sent the second letter telling people that it was okay to drink their water.
And in the first letter you reported last night on WBTV.com, the final version of the do mm-hmm. not drink letter that was sent out included this sentence: while this recommendation represents the maximum in health protection, your well would still meet all the criteria of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act for public drinking water sources. So if I were a recipient of that letter, and on the one hand it says don't drink your water, and on the other hand it says, well, it still meets all the criteria the federal government sets, what would I do?
What they did was not drink their water, and ultimately Duke Energy started providing bottled water to these people.
Right.
That is exactly the point in the state scientist that Tom was talking about, Dr. Ken Rudo. That is what he was so vocally opposed to putting this language in, because he said it was confusing.
Yeah.
And he said his job as a state epidemiologist in the public health section –
toxicologist. He's a toxicologist.
Thank you. Was his job was to make it and communicate with well owners and residents as clearly as possible.
All this is adding up to the fact that for the first time in 25 years, the Charlotte Observer has failed to endorse Pat McCrory. What was your reasoning?
Well, many, but that, you know, the coal ash thing is definitely a part of it. HB2, you know, just he's not the governor we thought we were getting, at least from the perspective of the newspaper that represents
really
Charlotte,
tough.
Which is a more moderate part
You're
of
really
this.
Tough. You said, and I quote here, McCrory's term as North Carolina governor is the ultimate illustration of the Peter principle, that people are promoted based on their past performance and not the abilities needed for the new rule, and thus rise to their level of incompetence. McCrory has certainly done that. Ouch.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at some of these things that we've been talking about, you see a governor who is, you know, trying, you know, to lead in the direction that he thinks the state should go in, but you keep seeing these little, you know, off ramps and, you know, side roads that he and his staff are, you know, either veering down or, you know, like their communications and how they've handled the coal ash thing, you know, where you have two highly respected, you know, state scientists, basically one thrown under the bus, the other one jumps off the bus in protest and just says, I cannot abide this. You have a situation like that. You have HB2, where you've got a need for the way our state government is structured, where most of the power does reside with the legislature, but when you elect a governor, you want that governor to still be able to at least be a large presence in the room and help push things in the right direction. What we see from HB2 and all these emails and correspondence is he was, you know, the guy following the wagon. Mm-hmm. The wagon was just rocking down the road, and he was running behind trying to catch up and go, hey, wait for me. You should turn left here, maybe. And, you know, the guys in the wagon leading it go, no, we're not turning left. We're going right. Get out of the way, you know.
So there you get the
reasoning. Just the lack of leadership.
You get the reasoning behind the Charlotte Observer's lack of an endorsement for the first time in 25 years of Pat McCrory, only here on the News Roundup on WFAE. So you also said that Roy Cooper, his opponent, is the superior choice. Why?
Well, he's got a long history in state government, you know, and I'm sure a lot of this would be obviously disputed by Pat McCrory and his campaign.
But now he doesn't like the Observer.
Well,
never has.
Well, we've endorsed him again and again and again and again.
I know, and but he doesn't like you.
He just hasn't given us enough reason.
But, you know, people think that he's thick-skinned, but he's really not. That was quite a surprise to learn, huh?
Yeah, his campaign actually put out a statement saying, how could the Charlotte Observer not endorse me? It really surprised me for a man who loves to slam that newspaper.
Yeah.
It was really surprised when I saw that email. Like,
yeah, I mean, he ran the campaign ad of our building being torn down.
Yeah, that's right.
And I say this all the time to people. Pat McCrory has never missed an opportunity to bash the press, be it the Observer or the press at large.
So, if I'm not mistaken, you are endorsing Deborah Ross over Senator Richard Burr in the Senate race. Why?
Yeah. Now, actually, we didn't say this in the editorial, but I kind of wish we had. Because I think...
Don't you write them?
Yeah, we did. Actually, I did. I specifically wrote that one. And I'm now thinking, why didn't I say this? This is really good. But basically, on that race, I think what you've got in Richard Burr is a guy who's been in Washington for 2 decades, and he's ready to come home. He almost, from everything we understand, he wasn't all that enthusiastic about doing another term. So what you're going to have, if he gets reelected, is a guy who is just mopping up, cleaning up, you know, finishing. You know, he's just going to, you know, log it, you know, like they say in baseball where you, you know, run out the grounder, you know, leg out the grounder. Is that how they say it?
Yeah.
When you know you're
it's public radio.
To,
we don't do many
yeah,
sports
too much
now.
Sports here.
Sorry.
But, get Delano on the phone.
But I think you're not going to get a really energetic, forward-looking term from Richard Burr. You know,
so do you,
and I think you would get that from Deborah.
Do endorsements Ross. Matter anymore? Did they ever?
That's a good question.
Well, they used to. I mean, there's no question about it. They used to. I mean, the interesting thing about endorsements is politicians love to tout them, but there is real question as to whether or not they have the oomph that they once
did. I think sometimes they matter even more in the down ballot races. You know, most of us, it's hard to imagine, don't know the big ones.
Well, we have a new city manager. We're going to switch gears in a second and talk about him and lots of CMS news to talk about. And Andos Helms is here, the education reporter for The Observer, and we're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with our roundtable of reporters, Eric Frazier, the editorial writer from the Charlotte Observer, Andos Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News, News Channel 3 on your side, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. We have a new city manager as we speak this morning. Marcus Jones is replacing Ron Carley. What do we know about why he was chosen and how many people were vying for the job? Because this came out of the clear blue sky.
Well, it didn't come out quite as blue. We just don't remember the thing that led up to it because the city council held 2 days of secret meetings at the Omni. Month?
Well, not secret. They were closed. I mean, we got the public notice saying they were having meetings. We knew what they were doing.
Yes, but they wanted
September
to be so
20th,
open about
which...
it, they reserved some rooms at the Omni where the public isn't open to. So, yeah, I'm going to call them a secret meeting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like CMS has done that at the airport.
Exactly. But we just don't remember because the day of the first – it was a Tuesday and a Wednesday, and it was the Tuesday that Keith Lamont Scott was shot.
Yeah.
And so they did these interviews amidst all of that, and so we just kind of forgot about it. But that being said,
who else did they interview?
Have stumped me on the rest of your questions.
We only know about the other one internal candidate who was a finalist, and I'm afraid I'm going to get her name wrong. But they did in some way disclose who the other finalist was after the fact, but they did not bring them out as they have in the past and say, here are two or three finalists.
And this morning in the paper, I'm not even sure he started in the job yet.
No, not until December 1st.
And in the paper this morning, there's already an article about his refusal in his previous position in Norfolk, Virginia.
Well, where he's still in that job.
Okay, well, he is still in the job of city manager in Norfolk, Virginia, where he has refused to release a string of text messages. You worked, Nick, in Norfolk on television.
For 2 years.
What do you know about Marcus Jones?
Well, I'll tell you that it's very telling. I worked there for 2 years as an investigative reporter, spent a lot of time interacting with city government in Norfolk, and I never met the man. And I say that it's telling because he did not make himself open and available to the media. He had a PR person, a spokeswoman, who interacted with the media on his behalf. But he
– we'll get him on this show, Mickey. Jealous.
Hey, you know, we'll see. Hopefully it'll take you less time than it did to get the governor on here. That being said, so you know, from a openness and transparency standpoint, it will be interesting because Norfolk is a much different culture. It's a smaller city.
But
more regional, right? It's part of a region that is, you know, only slightly smaller than Charlotte, but okay. Norfolk, the city. But it is the economic and business center of that region.
And that region is what? Norfolk,
Hampton Roads. So Norfolk, Virginia Beach, it's six cities. Yeah. But, you know, that coastal tidewater, whatever you want to call it, Hampton Roads, Virginia. But he has done a lot in terms of building up the city center, revitalizing downtown Norfolk. The 2 years I lived there, I lived downtown and was interrupted by construction every morning because there's a lot of it going on down there. So that is probably his lasting legacy in Norfolk is the revitalization.
Well, he said that he made a point of saying that he made Norfolk into a data-driven organization that's efficient, effective, accountable, inclusive, responsible, and customer-focused. And he went on to say that from time to time, he would have his senior staff recite that mantra. And if they couldn't do it successfully, he'd have them drop and do 50 push-ups. Is that true?
No, he actually said that was a joke. Not the 50, the 50 push-ups.
But they're also saying they're bringing him in because they want to build up a better sense of morale among the staff. Yeah. And this does not necessarily sound like a guy who'd be easy to work for.
I think that he got decent marks within the city. Like within his staff, I think that and developers liked him. I think, you know, it's those externally. The other interesting the other interesting thing, they launched a big initiative when I was living there about being customer focused, and I called for something once, and they said, "Please, we've launched this new thing. We are committed to calling you back within 3 days." That was an improvement in customer service.
I guess that's a, you know, we need to know the scale. What was the original time?
Probably correct.
The key thing to me, though, is, you know, the Charlotte City Council and this new city manager, they really want to focus on building community trust. It's difficult to do that with someone who is not out in front. And say what you want about Ron Carley, but Ron Carley was present.
Yeah, he was hired to be
president. That's almost why he got in trouble.
That's exactly right. He was hired to be the face and the voice of the city, and then the council changed, and they didn't like that. That's essentially, in a nutshell, what we think happened. Yeah. We don't really know what happened.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see with this guy how he walks that fine line with city council, being out front but not outshining city council and the mayor. That's a tough balancing act.
He did that in Norfolk for most of his tenure. The mayor just stepped down, you know, retired after being mayor for 22 years. So he's used to being with a long, entrenched, you know, elected board.
Is the city set up the same way? Is it a strong or a weak mayor system in Norfolk?
Yeah, it's the same way, Charlotte.
Okay. He's coming in with a salary of $329,000 plus $5,700 car allowance a year and temporary housing allowance of $2,000 a month for a year.
Yeah, I think
does that sound reasonable?
I think
to
Ron Carley wants to talk with whoever helped him negotiate his contract.
Is that what I'm getting in my next contract?
If you're making $329,000 a year, do you need a temporary housing allowance of $2,000 a month? Really?
In fairness, the $329,000 a year that you're making reference to actually includes
some deferred compensation.
Yes,
which is more than you make.
Yes, but here's the point. I made the joke about scale with your phone call response. In comparison, Ron Carley, $245,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So this is a significant increase in salary.
And Ron Carley had real bona fides.
Yes.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think when you do a national search, when you go outside and you're recruiting somebody that you view as a star, you tend to see those jumps in salaries.
So WBTV received emails concerning the type of questions that Charlotte City Council wanted to ask of applicants applying for the manager's position. How did you get those emails?
In a public records request, I requested stuff related to HB2 discussions. Uh-huh. And at the same time they were emailing about that, they also were emailing about the questions that they were going to ask the city manager. Although it's interesting, they provided the emails discussing the question, with the discussion amongst the council, the questions, the types of questions they wanted to ask, but they refused to provide the actual list of questions, and they claimed that it was confidential personnel, yeah. Which I didn't have time to argue with them and tell them that they're wrong, but they're wrong. But so we don't know the actual list of questions, but we know that stuff included the fire department, the police department, community relations, what have you.
So 2016 is going down in the history books as the year of the email, and that email equates to living dangerously. Yes. Don't put anything in an email, ever.
Or just don't write it down.
I was going to say, I think most of us figure that out. Except, don't put it in writing if you don't want it to get into the wrong hands.
If you're subject to public records, please put everything in an email.
Public officials, disregard.
There was also news this week, Ann, that unlike the last few times we've gone through the superintendent of schools hiring process, this time they will not be, probably not be, parading the candidates around. Why not?
Will there ever be a real process? Are we going to hire a superintendent?
I believe they are hiring. They have closed applications. They took applications in September, and they have 51 as of the close of applications. I'm sure 51 will not be serious contenders. The search firm is now starting to background and vet and figure out who's really a significant match, and there will be then some interviews, again, whether it happens in a secret location, whether it's done by Skype. They are saying it's really important to keep things confidential up until the agreed-upon point. And in the past,
is that because the superintendents don't like, the potential candidates don't like to be paraded around because it puts their present job
exactly
in jeopardy?
If you're the superintendent of whatever district now, you know, if we're really old, we remember Eric Smith making his professions of how his heart was in Charlotte while he was actively interviewing in other districts. It's not convincing at that point. So I totally understand that the applicants don't want to go public. So I think when they're saying, well, we'll leave it up to them, I think it's unlikely that anybody's going to say, given the choice, yeah, I want to go out and be exposed and then maybe have the whole world know I didn't get the job.
So do we know? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I understand that rationale. I really do. But as a parent, as a CMS parent, I hope at some point before a final decision is made that they will, the board will do something to introduce the finalists to the public and to CMS parents for a very simple reason. I get the arguments. It's a fair argument to make, but this is not a normal time in CMS. What they are looking to do is significant, and the trust factor there with parents and schools and everything else, I would argue, is not on firm footing right now.
Do they know what they're looking for? Have they decided what they're looking for, what the characteristics of
the they have the usual Superman list.
Right.
You know, they want everything. They want integrity, which one would hope would go almost unspoken, but it is at the top of their list. They want integrity. They want someone who's an educator. There's been kind of a pulling away from this rhetoric that was so big a few years ago about bring in an outsider, bring somebody with a business point of view. They're saying, of course, they have to be able to manage a $2 billion business.
Right.
But they need to be an educator at heart. They need to really care about the kids. They need to be able to work with teachers. They need to be a smart politician to work with the legislator and the county commissioners.
And you are reporting in the newspaper that there is lingering frustration over the way CMS pushed out Heath Morrison as superintendent. I don't even know how long ago that was now.
2 years ago.
Because it's eroding trust in the current search for the superintendent. Talk about that.
Well, it was a really interesting process. They always go out and talk to the public in some way about what you want in a superintendent. And again, you get this laundry list of we want everything. But in this case, there were two parallel tracks for that. The search firm that has been hired by the board did
McPherson and Jacobson.
McPherson and Jacobson, right. And they
from
did
Nebraska.
Invitation-only small group discussions and with the invitations coming from school board members trying to get a really good representation. And then they held some public meetings. And then MECED, which is a nonprofit local group, held their own round with the board's blessing, I believe, although it was interesting because there were two different schedules being published. And now we got two different reports. And one was presented at a special board meeting this week. That was the one from the search firm. It was much more general. They asked about the positives. They asked about what do you see as good about this community, good about the school district. And what they got was more concern about this, the Broad Institute, the sort of corporate-focused training that was identified with Peter Gorman. MACED, on the other hand, heard a lot, apparently, about we went through a search a couple of years ago. We got a superintendent and
– that people really liked. They liked
a lot
Heath
of people,
Morrison.
Right. A lot of people really liked Heath Morrison. And right up until the whole relationship fell apart, it seemed like the board liked Heath Morrison and trusted him. And then all of a sudden, boom, it was over. So what they're saying is, why should we – everybody agrees that the last go-around didn't work terribly well. There's a lot of disagreement about who's responsible for it not working well and whether it was a bad hire or a bad breakup. But – yeah, there's definitely.
Well, what people want is transparency. They don't understand what happened to Heath Morrison. It was over in the blink of an eye with no explanation. And I think they're both sides. Heath Morrison and the board are locked into secrecy because of a separation agreement. We will never know what really happened. And people are ticked off about that. It's a public position.
Right. And the North Carolina law does provide a lot of protection for personnel, but it also provides for a board to choose to waive that when they believe that the credibility of the institution is at stake. And I think there would have been a real strong argument for doing that and being more candid about
On another CMS topic, they announced this week that they're stopping pay for the suspended principal of the Park Road Montessori School. She had been and continues to be, I believe, on suspension during what has become a 9-week investigation. They've already fired the school's senior administrative secretary for allegedly stealing $15,000. What's the story here? Do we know?
I just don't know. No, I've gotten nothing on that. Of course, there's a lot of buzz. This is a magnet school that pulls people from around the county. These are parents who really care deeply about the school and about the Montessori method. A lot of them are very frustrated that the belief is that it is related to the embezzlement, and not that the principal did the embezzlement, but that it happened on her watch. Whether that's true or not, I can't be sure, but there's a feeling that she's being punished for what someone else did. She was also on medical leave during some of the stretch, and there are people who think she ought to be in there as they're expanding the Montessori program.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You mentioned the magnet program, and CMS is continuing to work on a new magnet plan. The school board is scheduled to vote on this in November, and some say this will be a national model. You say local reviews so far are mixed. Where does that stand? Has the public seen any of this yet?
Yes, they have. CMS has been rolling it out over the last couple of weeks. It's been relatively low-key so far, and that's always an interesting thing with student assignment. You never quite know when it goes from 0 to 60, which
right.
always
and
seems to
happen.
And
it will go from 0 to 60.
It will. It may not be this round, because this is focused on magnets.
All right. Moving on very quickly to the U.S. National Whitewater Center. They're operating under new water quality rules, and at a recent Mecklenburg County Commission meeting about this, Dr. Marcus Plesha, who is the county's health director, described those rules.
There will be daily monitoring by the facility of the chlorine levels, and also there will be daily monitoring of water quality and organic accumulation to make sure there's not a lot of buildup of sediment at the facility. The facility will be required to keep records of this, which we will review when our inspectors go out to inspect. We will send inspectors out 4 times a year to inspect the facility and to review the records at that time. We will then prescribe actions to be taken if the levels fall outside of the standards set by the rule, and if necessary, impose any penalties or remedies if there are problems with the ongoing regulation.
How are these rules different?
There are some.
That's
right. I mean, there was literally no monitoring or any guidelines set up for the Whitewater Center. Unfortunately, it took this girl's death for someone to think, oh, gee, we really ought to figure out how to do this. And so now, I mean, really, we've established some guidelines that we're going to follow to ensure that the water quality at the Whitewater Center isn't one that kills people.
We don't have time to play what I think is an extraordinary piece of tape because we're out of time. But Jeff Wise, who's the CEO of the Whitewater Center, appeared at this county commission meeting. He's been completely absent from all of this since it all began.
Except for the first day when he issued a press release that said it's not our fault.
Well, he did talk to us.
Pat Cotham, in her statement to him at the board meeting, said this. We don't have time to play the actual cut. Mr. Wise, it's nice to meet you.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing to me that he has been absent. We'll just leave it at that. We've stumped the panel because it's amazing to all of us. We actually tried to get him on this program. He talked to the news department?
He talked to Michael Tomczyk, yeah, and you can find his report online.
All right. That's it for today. That's all the time we have for today. Nick Oxner here from WBTV News, Ann Doth Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer, and the conspicuously absent Tom Bullock, who has returned to the fold after a long time off. Thank you all for the hour.